Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people all across the country. I'd like to acknowledge my elders past and present and the elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to our listeners if you tuned in across the nation via the National Indigenous Radio Service. And if you're listening on the website, 989fm.com.au, or on our podcast a little bit later, welcome to you as well. It's really good to have your company here, nearly the end of the week, a beautiful Thursday here in Brisbane. Now, last month, the inquest into the death in custody of a 22-year-old Yemiji woman, Miss Jew, concluded. We've already heard many of the horrendous circumstances of her death, with several devastating failures of duty of care already admitted to by police officers and health professionals during the inquest. Now, Miss Jew died because she was Aboriginal, she died because she was a woman, and she died because she was poor. We've spoken a lot on this program about how the violence faced by our women is so often overlooked. I mean, you only have to look at the fact we barely know many of the women whose deaths were investigated by the Royal Commission into Aboriginal deaths in custody to attest to this fact. Now there's a national conversation beginning into family violence. Last week we had the Victorian Royal Commission into Family Violence handing down its recommendations, including specific recommendations for Aboriginal women. But often this conversation around family violence excludes the vastly different way Aboriginal women experience violence in Australia. For example, Miss Jew was a domestic violence victim and she died from an infection that spread from her a broken rib. Now, as we await the coroner's findings, I find it helpful to look to our Indigenous sisters overseas. In Canada, Aboriginal women are also the fastest growing incarcerated group in the country. And the country's new Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, has announced a nationwide investigation into the cases of thousands of missing and murdered Aboriginal women. There are conservative estimates that 1,200 Aboriginal women have disappeared since 1984. Most of them are expected to be homicides. Now, this morning on Let's Talk, we have two very special guests. We're speaking to Krista Big Canoe, who is the Legal Advocacy Director of the Aboriginal Legal Services in Toronto and is currently counsel to six families in the First Nation Youth Death Inquest in Thunder Bay. And we also have Shireen Razak, who is a professor at the University of Toronto and also wrote the book Dying from Improvement, Inquests and Inquiries into Indigenous Deaths in Custody. Now, we're just trying to get them on the line this morning, so we might just go to a quick break. Here's Shelley Morris, and we'll be back with Krista and Shireen. Good morning. Welcome back to Let's Talk, where we're speaking to two very special guests all the way from Canada, our Indigenous sisters and brothers over there. We've got Krista Big Canoe, who's the Legal Advocacy Director of the Aboriginal Legal Services in Toronto, and also Shireen Razak, who's a professor at the University of Toronto and actually wrote a book, which I'm hoping to get my hands on at some point, Dying from Improvement, Inquests and Inquiries into Indigenous Deaths in Custody. And they're actually over here on a project specifically looking at the similarities in settler colonial violence in both Australia and Canada. First of all, Krista, can you tell me a little bit your mob and your country?
Oh, certainly. I'm from Canada, and I'm actually Anishinaabekwe, which is a First Nations descendant from an island. Its English name is Georgian Island First Nation. We actually, in traditional language, refer to it as Wasi'egaming, which means lake or place of shining waters. And so it's in Ontario, which is about 45 minutes to an hour north of Toronto.
Right. So you work and you sort of grew up on country, did you?
Pardon me?
You work and you sort of grew up in your traditional country.
Yes, yeah. We actually, Aboriginal Legal Services does work throughout Ontario and sometimes in other parts of Canada as it relates to inquiry and inquest process. But for the most part, I'm in essentially the general vicinity of the traditional territory of my people.
And Shireen, can you tell me a little bit about your background and how you got into this line of work?
Yes, I am originally from the Caribbean. My family emigrated to Canada when I was a teenager, so I've lived in Canada for a very long time. My background in terms of this kind of work is that I began as a feminist scholar looking at violence against women and immediately began to think about the ways in which racialized and Indigenous women have a different experience in the law. So my focus has often, has all along been in the law.
Krista, you were talking a little bit previously, because I opened the show by mentioning a really conservative estimate about the number of Aboriginal women who have disappeared since 1984, and I put it around 1,200, but that's actually incredibly conservative, isn't it? There's been new numbers that have actually been acknowledged by the Government of Canada.
Yes, well, with the call into the national inquiry, three of the ministers who is part of their mandate under the Prime Minister's letters have been directed to call the inquiry. And essentially, they had started pre-inquest and pre-inquiry meetings throughout Canada, mostly meeting first with families and then with experts of various knowledge. And the Minister for the Status of Women, Patty Haidu, has recently said very publicly and in media that, you know, the reality is 1,200 is conservative and it may be as many as 4,000.
Where did this come from, this severe undercounting of the numbers?
Well, it's not actually the first time we've had the undercounting of the numbers. The Native Women's Organization of Canada, Association of Canada, had done a campaign for a number of years called Sister in Spirit. And they had been indicating numbers around 580 or 600. They had created their own database and had actually been doing a lot of publicity and media around the numbers. And there was a lot of pushback with the former government in place, that particularly in the House of Commons. There was at one point in the Hansards a debate how that number overguesstimated the actual problem. And, you know, numbers were being tossed around in 200-300. And essentially, when the RCMP report came out, that's the Royal Canadian Mounted Police report, it acknowledged having combined numbers of the National Police Service with some other police services that there were at least 1,200.
Right.
But there are problems with those numbers as well because of the way they define missing or murdered.
Right. How do they define them, I guess?
Well, I mean, it's reported, right? So one, it's on a reported basis, and two, it's only where they have knowledge that it's an Indigenous person. And, you know, so reliance on their own assessment isn't always the most legitimate or best approach, because much like in Australia, there are a number of Indigenous folks that have mixed ancestry, and so you can't base it on appearance alone. And often, you know, so that's one of the problems. The other problem is just the way things are categorized in terms of where an investigation's at and in terms of a solve rate. And so there, in Canada, there is a legal strategy coalition that is started off as ad hoc but have done a number of reports that are publicly available. And actually part of the work we do is to criticize the RCMP reports and to highlight sort of the inaccuracies that exist.
It's interesting because when you hear a lot of these, you know, about solved rates and everything like that, it seems like Aboriginal women are, I guess, re-victimised. Shireen, you actually look a lot about sort of the intersections with the criminal justice system and Aboriginal women specifically. I mean, why, what are the sort of factors that come into play when, just say, a family goes to a police station and reports their loved one missing?
Well, I think one of the overriding assumptions that governs the process right from the beginning and all the way through to the end is that the violence is assumed to be coming from within Aboriginal communities. So it is assumed, for example, that it's Aboriginal men who are murdering Aboriginal women. And this assumption then leads to a kind of logic where the violence is simply some kind of cultural property. Mm. And so courts, you know, in sexual assault cases, for example, would consider that as simply a cultural practice of some sort. It's crazy logic, but that's how, you know, I initially saw this kind of discounting of violence against Indigenous women. There is also a very strong tendency to blame Indigenous women for their own fate. Yeah. So to say, for example, that they're practicing a high-risk lifestyle, which is a phrase that inquests, inquiries, courts have loved, and you know, to basically say that the violence has happened because they've exposed themselves to it. So that's been the legal response.
It's interesting, and feel free to jump in at any time, either of you, but it's really confronting, I guess, to look at this from an Australian perspective, because we finally have this sort of focus on family violence and rates of family violence over here in Australia, but it seems like there's a completely different conversation happening in Canada at the moment. I mean, what do you see as the main differences when you come to these shores and sort of realise that over in Canada, I guess, largely the focus on this being just a solely Aboriginal problem, that's just violence committed against Aboriginal men and Aboriginal women, has sort of stopped the conversation around missing and murdered Aboriginal women, and here we're having a conversation specifically about violence within our own communities. Does it seem like a very different conversation to you both when you come here?
Well, I think one of the things that has made it different is that there have been sort of spectacular instances of violence and murder of Indigenous women by white men. So, for example, Robert Picton, described as a serial killer, which can be misleading, killed all of those women in from the downtown east side of Vancouver and subjected them to really extreme annihilation. And so that, I think, those kinds of things forced Canada a little bit to make sure that, to make the conversation about what white men do. Whereas I don't see much of that happening here in Australia, and because you've had such spectacular colonial moves such as the Northern Territory intervention, you can quite clearly see here the state moving to use this kind of criminalization of violence by Aboriginal men as a reason to sort of move in, take over, preempt, and so on. So I don't think, I think we are not innocent and we are heading in that direction. And it is one of my biggest fears that even this inquiry that we're about to have will somehow end up labeling the problem as one of internal violence.
Yeah, right. It's interesting because they're already trying to characterize it as that. Christy, you mentioned the RCMP reports, and I remember reading a news story, I think it was last year, when they actually did their own investigation into this, and they did say something like 70% were family violence cases, largely overshadowing that problem of non-Aboriginal men sort of murdering and hurting Aboriginal women. There was more of a focus, I guess, less of a focus on the race of the perpetrator.
And sorry, this is Krista. An interesting thing about that, and I mean, it's disputable, the RCMP report, for a number of reasons, like the methodology and logic doesn't flow accurately. One of the things that is known in terms of domestic violence and harm, regardless of race, is that a lot of it is perpetrated in the context of family or domestic violence. And when you actually do comparative analysis, it's not much different than other racialized groups, including non-racialized groups. One of the other things that's really happened in Canada that's sort of taking the conversation away from it just being focused on family violence is actually the very well-reported incidents of state or police harm to Indigenous women as well. So in Quebec, we've had an instance where the Quebec Sûreté had been causing sexual harm and assault against Indigenous women, and that became very publicized in the Plains. We also had an RCMP officer who took an incarcerated Indigenous woman out of the cells and took her home to pursue what he was referring to as relationship. And so we've had a number of incidents across the country where there's been a recognition that police or state harm is actually occurring as well. And once it gets that publicized, it does change the dynamic of the conversation. That's not to say that some of the conversation is not focused. And I do share Shireen's concern that it will redirect itself specifically to Indigenous community perpetrating harm against Indigenous community without actually looking at the colonial legacy that's led to a number of the harms and the root causes and poverty that actually contribute to overall violence against Indigenous women.
Shireen, you mentioned that you were a feminist scholar, and I guess the conversation around family violence has been largely, in Australia at least, has largely been viewed through a feminist lens. But when you look at particularly Aboriginal women, and picking up, I guess, what Krista was saying a little bit about the colonial legacies, I mean, when you look at particularly the intersections with the justice system, what are sort of the, I guess, the colonial underpinnings that have led to, I guess, some of this violence against our women, Aboriginal women?
Well, the most colonial line that you can trace from the beginning is simply the idea that Aboriginal life is worth very little, but also the really obvious implication that if you can destroy Aboriginal women, you destroy Aboriginal communities, and you become the owners of the land.
So it's, I guess, Krista, it is sort of that continuing sort of method.
I'm sorry, Amy, I can't hear you very well.
Sorry. I can't hear you either.
Sorry. We've got, just for our listeners, we've got Shireen and Krista on two separate lines, so sorry about that. But Krista, just picking up on that about the colonial sort of, I guess the generational sort of assimilating out of Aboriginal people as a whole, I mean, do you see this as part of that continuing genocide, I guess?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't think there's any possibility, if you're ever going to give meaning to actually addressing the issues, to separate the sort of continuation of colonialism. Like in the advocacy work I do, and I represent families who have missing or murdered Indigenous women, and one of the really important things I hear over and over again from the surviving families is the connection back, like harm to the land is harm to Indigenous women's body, and it's sort of based on this colonial perspective. And the dialogue we're often hearing in Canada is less than worthy victims. Yeah. So Indigenous women are often seen as less than worthy victims. If I might, a really quick story. Just recently in Thunder Bay, Ontario, there was a woman, an Indigenous woman, who was a sex worker, who was assaulted, and the John attempted to drown her. She escaped, fleeing naked through the streets, asking for help, and two bystanders stopped and helped her and covered her up with his cardigan or his sweater. And when the police showed up, the moment, first of all, the bystanders noted that because she was Indigenous, she seemed to be treated differently. Mm. And once they found out she was a sex worker, they almost dismissed any concern she had. And the police have taken the position that there's no need to lay any charges. Which is ironic because, you know, attempted murder in any other context would require charges.
That just seems so obvious, you know. Like over here we talk a lot about sort of, I guess, police officers, they can't really see their bias, you know. They're viewing things very much through this white lens. But that is just such an obvious example. I mean, do you see a situation where that's going to change anytime soon? It seems to be a real problem with police culture and the way that they view Aboriginal victims particularly. This is for either of you, by the way. Maybe Shireen, if you'd like to answer that.
Well, it's difficult to see an end to it because if you think about the fact of what it does, what does all this sexual violence do? You know, the American scholar Andy Smith has a really good phrase that I really like to quote, which is that sexual violence is how you do colonialism. Yeah. If that's your game, you're going to need to do a lot of this to keep it working. And since we still have an ongoing colonialism, then there's going to be ongoing sexual violence. And, you know, rather than make those things kind of vague, let's make them concrete. It is really important for settlers to imagine that Indigenous life is worth very little. It's very hard to shift that.
Yeah.
Because in order to shift it, you have to question settler legitimacy.
Yeah, and do you see that? I mean, we had two First Nations academics over here last year, and it was shortly after the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, had been elected, and he'd just announced sort of this inquiry into missing and murdered women, and sort of the feeling I got from them was that we sort of have to wait, but it looks promising. Krista, a year on from that and the year on from sort of the inquiry being announced, where do you see the current situation at the moment?
Well, it's interesting because the ministers that have been tasked with calling the inquiry haven't actually put out any substantial document. There's been the promise, there's been pre-meetings, but we don't yet know what an inquiry will actually look like. And so, you know, a lot of it will depend on what it looks like, whether they're going to be using just the legislation that enables a national inquiry to be called, or whether they'll be looking at parallel processes such as an investigative bureau or more traditional or Indigenous means of parallel process. And so, you know, it's uncertain where it's at, but one thing that I can say is when the ministers went out, the first round they went out on was to meet with the families. And it's one of the things that I've been advocating for a long time is that you need to talk to the surviving families and the people that are left without their loved ones to understand. And that has to inform any process from the beginning right through to implementations of recommendations. So in one way, that's been helpful. But, you know, a caution is you can't just call families together in one instance and hope that that's the last opportunity they're provided to actually be part of this process,
yeah.
or the process will dramatically fail in making any actual substantial change.
I guess what, speaking to so many families of people who've had their loved ones sort of ripped away from them, what's the sort of sentiment, I guess, the feeling? It must be very hard because largely they haven't been heard, have they? I think that adds to the trauma a bit.
It's Chris again. Absolutely. And I mean, in the prior government, we had Stephen Harper, who, you know, notoriously had been, when asked by one of our large and well-recognized media figures in Canada, you know, what about a national inquiry? And he literally stated, it's not high on our radar. And that was very indicative, of, particularly of that era of government. But, you know, looking back further, this concept that voices not being heard of those, but it's the most vulnerable voices and the most important voices, quite frankly, when we're talking about these issues. And so, you know, I think it becomes very normative that Indigenous people feel that they're not heard, or they feel not hopelessness, but there's a relentless advocacy that occurs where people aren't listening. And so it's only been sort of in the last little while where not only media and circumstance and incidents of like high-profile violence have occurred, that starting at least a national discourse or conversation, and not amongst everyone, probably largely amongst feminists and sort of advocates or allies in the area, but, you know, you can actually come across the conversation in mainstream outside of those normal circles. So there's something happening that at least is putting in tune the issue.
Shireen, I just wanted to pick up on that, what Krista was saying about feminism, because a big frustration of mine in Australia is that a lot of the conversation is largely focused, I guess, on mainstream feminism, and there's sort of a push to try and make your feminism intersectional, I guess, but I think a lot of, I guess, feminists are largely failing. They really fail to take into account how a lot of the policies they sort of promote could disproportionately impact on the most vulnerable, specifically Aboriginal women. Is that a problem in Canada?
Well, I think the biggest problem right now with respect to that is that when non-Aboriginal feminists propose ideas as to how we should understand this violence, they generally use concepts that may work, although I would even question that, may work well for example, white women, but will not work for Indigenous women. And here's an example. When we see, you know, 4,000 missing and murdered Indigenous women, do we call that a problem of male violence against women?
Right.
Because if we do that, then we're in this position of arguing that Indigenous women are simply more vulnerable victims of male violence. What about if we called it colonial violence?
Right. Yeah.
Or, you know, or even terror, which is something that I advocate, then we're not in that framework that I think is very counterproductive, where we're using vulnerability and we're saying, you know, there's one vulnerable group and then there's another that's twice as vulnerable and another that's three times as vulnerable. But that kind of mathematical approach to male violence is not going to get you anywhere near to colonialism.
That's so true.
In your analysis.
I mean, you've just articulated something that's been a source of frustration, because we do have sort of this great focused on male entitlement and the patriarchy, but as you mentioned before with the case of the anti-intervention, I mean, it wasn't just Aboriginal men being these horrendous sort of, I mean, a lot of them are victims as well, but it wasn't that problem. It all, the problems all stemmed back from that colonial legacy and the legacies from an invasion and the trauma that seeped down the generations. But it's a very shallow debate over here. Have you sort of encountered that when you sort of broached the topic over in Australia?
In Australia?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I haven't had too many opportunities to discuss violence against women here, but every time I ask about, you know, what is your equivalent phenomenon to missing and murdered women, generally people are sort of either they can't name any particular thing, although I do talk to a lot of experienced people who say, well, we just don't acknowledge it here in Australia.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I could name several cases. If you ever look up the Barrowville murders or Malcolm Naden, who was he was actually an Aboriginal serial killer in New South Wales, but his two victims were Aboriginal mothers, and they were just not their families were just not taken seriously by the police at all. So I think it's that problem of acknowledgement that we're so far behind. And I mean, I wonder if it's, Krista, a reason, one of the reasons is because as a whole, Australia doesn't have treaties. We're so far behind on, you know, we have racism in our constitution. I mean, it's really hard. Obviously, Canada has problems as well, but just the fact where we are as a country in Australia, do you think that bleeds into it, the fact we have so much more unfinished business over here than in Canada?
Well, that's interesting because, you know, in terms of unfinished business, I think we can, like, as Indigenous people, look across at each other's communities and recognize some of the good things that we wish we had in our own. Yeah. And so I don't think we're that much further along in Canada on treaties. Have we had some good cases? Absolutely. And so has Australia, right? And so, interestingly, in this discourse, in this conversation we're having about national inquiry, although those who advocate for it would recognize that, you know, adhering or investing in the treaty relationship, and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission also said this, would actually create better reconciliation and better partnerships and better understanding. This is not the actual conversation that's having that's occurring with the national inquiry. It's not like, hey, let's address treaties or look where we're at in terms of reconciliation first. It's actually focusing a lot more on sort of the mainstream and also the process, the Canadian legal process that will address the issue and how can it address the issue, as opposed to, you know, looking at. So it's interesting because the Prime Minister has made comments to the effect that, you know, we need to work on our treaty relationship. We need to work on this treaty people to treaty people relationship. And even when you look at the mandate letters to each minister that are sort of directed to sort of help build this relationship, it's not actually language. I mean, the words treaty to treaty relationship are there, but that's about as far as it goes. And so interestingly, I don't think it's that we're so much further ahead in that part of the process. I think a lot of this has been, like, you know, when you talk to advocates who have been advocating in the area for 30 or 40 years around these same issues, they say it's literally been a tide or a turn in the last couple of years with the very publicized and the media uptake recognizing these. And so it's kind of taken a big moment and a big motion. And the big thing that really impacted, I think, or brought more Canadians or allies on board was the Idle No More movement.
Oh, right, yeah.
And so it was a grassroots movement started by Indigenous women that was peaceful learn-ins and at round dances that were popping up all over the country in large urban centers where, you know, they'd block roads, they'd play drums, and people would join the round dance. And it became this opportunity, and it was a moment. Like, when we look back a number of years from now, we're going to recognize that this was, you know, a moment in Canadian history where a movement actually made a difference.
Yeah, it's very exciting. I remember watching from over here and just thinking, wow, if we'd had an Idle No More movement around the time the intervention was happening, for example, I was really just blown away by the strength of First Nations people over in Canada. We might just take a break and go to a song. I'm speaking to Shireen Razak, who's a professor at the University of Toronto and has written the book Dying from Improvement, Inquests and Inquiries into Indigenous Deaths in Custody, and Krista Bigkanoo, who is a legal advocacy director of the Aboriginal Legal Services in Toronto. So we'll be back after the short break.
If you missed today's show or would like to hear Let's Talk Again, catch the repeat from 7 p.m. weekdays or listen via the podcast at 989fm.com.au. Here's Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk, where we're having a really important conversation around colonial violence, not just in Australia, against Aboriginal women, not just in Australia, but in Canada. And we're joined by two very special guests who are actually down in Sydney at the moment. Krista Bigkanoo, who's a legal advocacy director of the Aboriginal Legal Services in Toronto, and Shireen Razak, who's a professor at the University of Toronto and the author of Dying from Improvement, Inquests and Inquiries into Indigenous Deaths in Custody. We've talked a little bit about the differences, I guess, between Australia and Canada. But Krista, you made a really good point just before the break that, just during the break actually, that there are also very important similarities that we have to acknowledge between the two countries.
Absolutely. Like, one thing we know, and you know, speaking with some of your academic scholars and legal advocates here has really actually helped me understand what the similarities are. And it would seem to me that Australia has, you know, we're kind of counting numbers or knowing numbers, but here it seems like it's an even larger problem in terms of numbers, but that those numbers aren't being recognized. So those are the big differences. But the big similarities is, you know, in Canada, amongst the Legal Strategy Coalition and other advocates, there's considerable agreement between reports about the root causes of violence against Indigenous women. And they really stress the economic and social marginalization of Indigenous women. So you start at the premise of the colonial legacy, but moving forward into contemporary issues of poverty and lack of opportunity, lack of education. In Canada, we have First Nations that don't have clean drinking water. They're often in states of emergency where there's high suicide rates. And there's some similarities where we can look at sort of the contemporary Indigenous landscape that's based and has been fostered on that colonial legacy to sort of marginalize the Indigenous people. But we need to actually recognize, as, you know, murders and women continue to go missing now, what some of those contemporary issues are and where the similarities are. Because I think in both countries, it's huge, huge economic disparity and social marginalization that is contributing to the continued loss of our women.
I would definitely agree. And Shireen, one thing I wanted to pick up a little bit from that when you talk about contemporary problems, I was shocked. I think it was last year, I was reading a report about how Aboriginal women in Canada were the ridiculous numbers over incarceration of Aboriginal women in Canada, which is similar to Australia, where we have where Aboriginal women are the fastest growing incarcerated group in the country. And it sort of just happened with no news. Hardly anyone has realized this. Now, you've done a lot of work in relation to Indigenous deaths in custody. Can you tell me a little bit more about that work and also the problem of Aboriginal women and the over-incarceration of Aboriginal women?
The previous 4 minutes of the conversation, because I wasn't hearing anything.
So sorry, I was just talking. I just realized I had your mic turned off, so sorry about that. I was just talking, we were just talking about the similarities between Australia and the root causes and the huge economic and social disparities between both Canada and Australia when we're talking about Aboriginal peoples. And I wanted to pick up on a contemporary problem that's facing both Aboriginal communities in both countries, and that's the problem of the over-incarceration of Aboriginal women. And I was really shocked to learn just how many Aboriginal women Canada incarcerated. And I was just wondering, that has a lot to do with your work, doesn't it? Can you tell us a little bit more about
that? Yeah, it is actually, I think it is the highest rate in the Western world. It's increased by 90% over a 10-year period. So it is really spectacular in terms of the increasing incarceration of Indigenous women. So they're increasing criminalization. And, you know, I really do think that this is the way into understanding how settler colonialism operates today. It is really obvious that it requires a targeting of Indigenous women. And that, you know, this really spectacular rate of incarceration, it beats back, for instance, even the rate of incarceration of black men in the United States. It is increasing that fast. And so when you ask yourself what is going on, obviously Indigenous women are not here being treated as the victims. They're being treated as the criminals. And this is a really spectacular change that we really must interrogate. What happens, I think, in inquests and inquiries is that very often, and even my book reproduces this, the focus is on the men dying in custody because more men die in custody.
It's so the same. It's almost like you're talking about Australia, because when we had our Royal Commission into Aboriginal Death in Custody, there was a number of women who were investigated and you wouldn't even know because the focus was all on Aboriginal men. I mean, what's the reason behind that?
Well, one of the reasons is that more men do die in custody. So that's very important to think about. And that has a lot to do with, you know, where people die, whether they die when they're being arrested, whether they die in, you know, on remand, whether they die in jails and so on. But there clearly is a statistic where more men are dying. But, you know, we shouldn't allow that to kind of take away from what do we recognize when we see an Indigenous death in custody. I think what really makes gender kind of disappear is that the overwhelming sort of the rate of death that so many people are dying.
Yeah, right.
That, you know, the impulse is, and I give in to that, is to call it a colonial phenomenon. And occasionally when it's driven by sexualized violence, which it often is with respect to women, you know, to name gender then, but then otherwise not to name it, because it's such a phenomenon that
it's happening
clearly,
to everyone.
Yeah, it's clearly about, you know, dispossessing a people.
Yeah, right. Would you agree, Krista, when you look at just how many Aboriginal women are incarcerated, and particularly how many Aboriginal men as well are incarcerated? It's just this whole colonial project, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, like in Canada, Shereen talked about the increase in recent times, but in federal custody, we know that 33% of the women federally incarcerated are Aboriginal. So that's one in three. And we see, you know, a lot of complications and around the trajectory of crime and where it starts. So when you look at the patterns, you see like not only an over-incarceration, but that's also tied to over-policing, stigma and stereotypes that place Aboriginal women into these situations. And so I absolutely agree with Shereen on that point. And when you see in custody, whether it's provincial custody, which varies from, you know, we have 10 provinces and 3 territories in Canada, but it varies somewhat, provincial custody, but provincial custody numbers are high as well. And what ends up happening is the higher there is an over-incarceration rate of Aboriginal people, the higher there's a likelihood there'll be more death in custody.
Yeah, right.
And the death in custody looks different. Sometimes it's OD-based, sometimes it's medical or refusal to provide medical care, the necessities of life. And other times, you know, it ties to suicide and self-harm, as well as other interactions within the facilities.
Shereen, can you tell me, I guess, an example? I mean, I know about the deaths of Frank Paul particularly, which was just shocking to me when I heard about that. And I know that you look into it in your book. But I guess what are sort of, Krista sort of outlined the reasons why a lot of Aboriginal people are dying in custody. Can you give me, like, I guess, an example from your book?
Well, there are different kinds of deaths. So in the case of Frank Paul and also in the case of the freezing deaths, we have police actively evicting Aboriginal people from the city under circumstances that are almost certainly to end in their death. Yeah. So if you're going to drive Aboriginal men out of the city and leave them outside without a coat or shoes in minus 30, then what you're really doing is signing the death warrant. Yeah. Or in the case of Frank Paul, if you're going to take a man who's obviously very ill and unable to walk and you're going to drop him in an alley in Vancouver on a cold, rainy night, then you are also signing his death warrant. So there are those kinds of deaths which are, you know, really, when you look at them closely, they really amount to murder.
Yeah.
But there is also the kind of death and that Krista alluded to, where there is simply a rather spectacular neglect, an utter failure to recognize Aboriginal suffering and to respond to Aboriginal people. So you have, for example, deaths where someone is crying repeatedly for help from their cells, and they're not getting it, and so they die. Or, you know, you have somebody obviously very ill, gravely ill, who nobody checks on. And that's really, you know, to me that was the most, one of the most important findings in my book. There is really a kind of systematized dehumanization.
Yeah, right.
Where so few of the state officials that are involved or medical personnel, so few are able to look at Indigenous people and see human beings. And so, you know, there's you know, very ordinary things like providing a blanket or, you know, when someone is groaning and screaming in pain, that you ignore it. These kinds of things are so mundane. They're every day. When you see that kind of dehumanization, you know you're in the presence of something that is much more than a few bad apples or a few negligent people.
No, because you've seen it, like you've seen the commonalities, I guess, between all those inquests that nothing's ever been done. Has there ever been any accountability over any of these deaths?
Well, Inquest play what I call the game of improvement, the game of colonial improvement, which is that they are a moment when the colonial state actually says, hey, we are being very responsible here. We're actually looking into the, you know, into these deaths and trying to figure out how they should not happen again. What are the things we need to change? But, you know, what is utterly remarkable about this game is that you can actually take Inquest for 100 years and see almost exactly the same recommendations, you know, implemented or not, and mostly not implemented. They don't change the situation, and they don't change the situation because what they're up against is this absolutely systematized inhumanity. And I think you've found the same things here since the, you know, this is the 25th anniversary of your Royal Commission. And your statistics are much worse. This sort of game of looking at the problem and trying to solve it, I mean, you have to wonder whether this isn't even part, a devious part of the colonial game altogether. Because it produces, it makes it worse.
It really does. Krista, I guess when you look at that, I mean, we had, Shireen mentioned our own Royal Commission, and there's currently that inquiry going into missing and murdered women. Would you like to see another inquiry into deaths in custody, particularly in Canada, or is it just going to be, you know, another inquiry that tells us the problems we all know about and nothing will ever be solved?
Well, see, and it's a good question you're asking because, you know, the need for a national inquiry is important because there has to be public accountability. It's not for the actual function or process, because I mean, easily we can identify up front what some of the deficits of that may be, but the actual national calling, the placing of importance, the recognizing the gravity of the situation in of itself is an important exercise, because it does cause, you know, discourse, it does cause conversations, it does cause opportunities for public to become informed. And you know, when you put it out there, and you got to keep pushing it, though, right?
Yeah.
And that's what you've made, like, one of the lessons maybe from your guys, RCAP, is that, you know, we had the same thing when we had a Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples, not specific to death. It's the 20-year anniversary of that as well, and very few of the recommendations were in place.
Right.
And so there's a need to sort of keep pushing, and I think in sort of the new social media age and media age, we do have opportunities we didn't have 20 and 25 years ago to sort of share this information and keep pushing some of the concepts and agendas that are particular to assist Indigenous advocacy. But we can't have just a whole bunch of sort of inquiries into particular processes. If we do that, we get lost, you know, in the forest.
Yeah.
We can't find the tree for the whole forest. And so, you know, one of the things that the Legal Strategy Coalition in Canada for missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls has really kind of been focusing on their advocacy recently is reminding all the provinces and territories that they have to get on board with this process, because it's multi-jurisdictional, much like it would be here in Australia as well, based on our constitution. There's a federal power and there's state or provincial powers. And so there really has to be an approach. And now every province and territory prior to the calling of a national inquiry supported a call for national inquiry, so it seems that, you know, they should be able to come to a place where they have a level of cooperation so that there's not stops along the way. And so it should be a more unified approach, or at least a recognition that there's multi-jurisdictions involved, because something like that is going to be more helpful than having a number of one-offs that speak to specific circumstance. And it won't get as far, because as Shireen mentioned, you know, when you look at inquest versus inquiry process or inquiry process, you see the same recommendations being repeated over and over again. And one of the reports that was put out in 2015 by the Legal Strategy Coalition looked at the 50 reports that Canada had looked at and some others, and actually analyzed 700 recommendations. Very few of those recommendations have been implemented. So, you know, a lot of us are feeling like the time for study, you know, it has to be very targeted study, but the time for study is over. It's been studied to death, literally. And what needs to happen is some of the implementation of these really sound recommendations that will make change. And so, you know, you don't need big processes to actually start making a difference or change in outcomes. And so there really has to be, you know, some action or sort of a quick win approach to trying to achieve change, because otherwise, you get that first important part of a national inquiry, but you don't get the satisfaction of actually having a meaningful implementation.
Yeah. Shireen, did you want to respond to that?
Well, I think one thing to remember is that inquiries and royal commissions are moments of public education. So, you know, that's both the promise and the peril of them, because it is a moment when something is going to get named and something is going to circulate. But what can easily circulate is a colonial truth, a colonial common sense. So, you know, if you have this big moment where everyone's paying attention to missing and murdered women and you have an inquiry and the inquiry ends up concluding that indigenous communities are entirely dysfunctional and that's what causes women to be murdered and disappeared, then what you have at the end of the day is a circulation of a colonial truth.
Right.
So you're always on this sort of point of contradiction, and you really have to be careful which way you go. I mean, people repeatedly ask me, you know, what do I think now that I've looked at the inquests and inquiries? Do I think that we shouldn't have any? And there are very smart, seasoned activists and scholars who actually would argue that we're better off without them. But I think that maybe it makes me a liberal, but I can't help thinking about, you know, this moment of naming something, you know, so that you put on record Canada is a place where 4,000 missing and murdered women exist. I mean, that's a big thing, and I almost want to look at how is the colonial state going to transform that into something that makes it look good.
That'll be very interesting.
Yeah,
I guess,
like,
it goes back
it
to blaming. I'm just wondering if a key point is going back to blaming Aboriginal people themselves, because that's what happens here.
Well, I think we can expect that, which is why anybody who is at all involved in this as an advocate has to be very, very careful about what language we use, what we call things. You know, not that that'll save us, but, you know, this is really a time for strategy, and it's not a moment to just adopt sort of old, for example, feminist truths and logics unreflectively. We really have to, make a bid for sort of articulating the specificity of violence against Indigenous women. There is something extremely specific about it. They're targeted for annihilation, and we must keep saying that. But, you know, I've been in these meetings too, and people look at me like if I'm, you know, from outer space, because I want to use words like annihilation.
Yeah, right. Language is very important, and that's the truth of it, isn't it? Krista, we don't have much time. For the last minute, I just wanted to ask you specifically as a First Nations woman, I guess, what does it feel for you to be constantly, I guess, what does it mean to you personally to have these sort of discussions and the importance of actually talking about that specific nature of Aboriginal violence against Aboriginal women?
I mean, it's a brilliant question. I can't answer it fully in a minute, but I can talk about why I actually continue to do this advocacy work. Is because I'm invested. I'm invested because it includes family members, it includes relatives and sisters and friends and a number of colleagues. And, I mean, it also includes a number of my clients. The majority of the work we do is victim advocacy and compensation in the residential school process, as well as in criminal injuries, in inquest work, and in advocacy of missing and murdered. And when you deal with that level of harm and pain, it's pretty much always around you, and there's opportunities for vicarious trauma, but there's also opportunities for healing and resiliency. Every time I feel somewhat defeated or sort of tired in this process, I have a client or an Indigenous woman and colleague and family remind me the strength of our women and why it's important to keep advocating and to keep raising the issue so that everyone else understands what it means.
That's a beautiful way to end it, and I wish we had more time, and I want to thank our guests today. We'll be back with